some of that group team effect, I think, tends to winnow out the minor comments and bring to the surface the more important comments. And the intention here is to provide the highlights of our comments, our most important, most significant comments. Of course, we start with a statement about our appreciation for the work that's been done by the panel. We know what a difficult job it is to wrestle all this information down to some sort of comprehensible summary. And so that appreciation is felt strongly by all the members of our team. So I'll start by mentioning that the way we've partitioned our comments here is to look at some of them, actually the most important comments, maybe the in terms of content, or really the new evidence or new information or additional information that we suggest should be incorporated by the panel, include presentations that will be presented tomorrow in our schedule. First, from Scott Pearson on interactions with pinnipeds. So it was a significant portion of our comments. And then also tomorrow, Ken Warhite will present a broad discussion on stock composition and size and age selectivity as part of a request from the panel to add to the total information for the panel. So moving on to comments that we've made, I'll try to be brief but give enough of an overview to get the context straight. We definitely start with the agreement with the panel's conclusion that we too are skeptical that the reduced Chinook harvest and focusing on the fisheries issue would have a large impact on the abundance of Chinook available to southern resident killer whales. We do believe that there is an impact. We actually would prefer to state that it is a small impact, but it definitely is an impact. Related to how small is the comments, we think that the panel has done a good job of presenting the features of the fishery, the lack of efficiency in converting fish if harvest is changed to available food for orca consumption. Ideas such as the mixed mature and immature fish in fisheries, and also this point about that the panel has made the orca harvest consists exclusively of Chinook stocks that are important to the killer whales. We think that that is a very important point, conclusion, and part of the evidence, the body of evidence, is strong. And we were concerned that the strength of that point was not substantiated by more stronger references. And so we suggest that strengthening the references to the stock-specific diet information of Hansen et al., for example, or the information about fisheries that was presented from Kyle Addicks from WFW and Workshop 2, or even the analysis that was conducted by Angelica Hagenbrough in Workshop 2 that focused on that the difference, the actually a smaller impact if you look at simply Fraser stocks, for example. Another related to this point about it being small, the impact, the curious reference of 20%, and maybe that's been clarified already. We haven't interacted with the panel specifically, but we did not understand where the reference to 20% came from. We weren't sure if it came from Eric Ward or Glenn DeVoy or Angelica Hagenbrough. There were generally the exploitation rates on stocks such as Puget Sound or Fraser range upward from 20% to higher levels in the 30s to 40s in total pre-terminal fisheries, so throughout the ocean marine environment. And so the 20% wasn't exactly there, but that was about the upper limit to the effect of a change, not an exploitation rate, not a harvest rate, but the upper limit on the total effect of increased prey abundance in the LaVoy or Hagenbrough presentations or analyses from the program. So that strengthening that, the source of that 20% in and of itself is, unless we understand the context or the definition of that, it's hard to ascertain whether or not the relative smallness or largeness or importance of that. In the section on critical missing pieces, and I'm trying to go somewhat in order here with comments through the panel's draft report, but the section on critical missing pieces of the talent fingerprint, we have a comment, and we know that there are some other comments here we're trying to not duplicate much, but we did have some curiosity about why the panel was recommending pursuing the talent fingerprinting when it seems to us that genetic stock identification methods are well-founded and well-known, and those methods are providing stock-specific estimates of diet samples, at least in the array of samples that have been taken primarily in the summer feeding area, in the Puget Sound Strait, one Puget Sound ones. And so we're not sure that the talent fingerprint, while corroborating the other methods, mapping of the contaminant fingerprints to individual stocks may not provide the specification to stock levels that are needed for management purposes. So we question whether or not that is really a critical need. In the section on and energetic needs, diet, here we, looking at the phrase that selectivity on different stocks is poorly known. There are a few places here in the draft report that it is stated that the diet is poorly known, but it does seem to us that the interpretation is correct, that it's well known in the summer and it's poorly known in the winter. And it may be that the report just needs to be clear about that. So when speaking to the poor quality of information, we assume that it's referring to winter feeding, but it's not really clear. The summer stock composition is well known. The samples are numerous and appear to be well known. I'm sure we'll still be collecting samples to further that information, but it does seem ample relative to winter. The idea that they have a selectivity or a preference is one that we think you might want the panel to consider maybe alternative language. And we did suggest in one case where the statement from the panel report, they have a strong preference for large Chinook, might have more of a, maybe it would be a more neutral statement that they primarily consume large Chinook from late spring to fall, or they primarily consume Fraser River Chinook during this period of time, rather than preference. We know of no studies that specifically get at preference or selectivity that are available here, but we understand, we think, and we are interpreting that these are general terms. Now, the ideas of selectivity with regard to stock and age will be discussed tomorrow, as mentioned, by Ken Warheit, and that's KW tomorrow. The Section 5, fishery and prey availabilities and general comments, we noted some confusion about statements about the, in this area of Part 5 where there's a discussion about stock distributions. And we see here this, in, at least in two places, that the panel is saying that certain populations would not be available. And so, pursuing the understanding of where, particularly in the winter, the uncertainty about the stock composition of diets and those samples, what stocks might they be chewing on? Well, it could be that the panel has gone a little bit too far, we suggest, in looking at some of the coated water tag information, for example, about different stocks. The discussion seems to be good. In fact, in one section earlier on, this point about Northern Oregon coastal stocks and Columbia River fall genetic stocks that are late maturing, far north migrating, are captured in fisheries in outside coastal waters off Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska. That would seem to, a reader would conclude that, well, they are generally available, those stocks. And yet, in the section 5.2, there's a conclusion, I'm not sure how rigorously dependent it is in the data, but it was generally that there may be stocks that are not available. That seems logical, but not all stocks are equally available. But it does seem, for example, that the many stock are available off, the coast of Washington. Routinely, in our genetic stock identification of fisheries off the coast of Washington, we see stocks from, certainly from Canada, the Fraser River stocks. We see stocks from Sacramento, Oregon Coastal and Sacramento Fall Chinook have contributed, like in 2009, recent estimates to our troll fishery contributed about equal numbers, about 15-20% of the total stock caught in the early portion of the commercial hook and line fishery there. So it can be significant. Also, the ranges of southern residents being as broad as they are from the tip of southeast Alaska down to California, maybe not known very well and precisely during the winter, but it certainly is broad. And the general tendency to look at, say, northern migration of northern distributed stocks such as Columbia River Upper Brights or Columbia River Summers, their tendency is to be up in southeast Alaska, but they really are available in just about equal numbers in Canadian fisheries. And there are times when we measure contributions of, say, Columbia River Summer Chinook, significant portions of the catch to our sport fisheries in the Strait of Juan de Fuca during the summer. So they do sometimes wander into the Strait of Juan de Fuca or Puget Sound. There's no doubt about it that the winter diet is poorly understood. That's agreed. But we were curious about a couple of points made by the panel about the speculating about the conceivable possibility that the winter months are more critical to successful reproduction survival of southern residents than relative to summer. We really didn't think that this was very clear, that is the basis for this statement, though it may be simply a possibility, a statement of a possibility. Certainly there is that, but there doesn't seem to be a basis, and it seemed odd that it was repeated. Again, it seems sufficient to say that the winter diet is poorly understood, and pursuing more information about that winter time frame is quite important. Additional analyses, we are interested in simulation analyses that might be performed, but we were somewhat confused by the statement, as the panel presented, that we should pursue the magnitude of realistic increases in salmon fisheries that would have a detectable effect. We, first of all, thought we were probably more concerned with decreases. What would decreases in fisheries mean? So that idea about increases is possibly a misinterpretation or a lack of appreciation for quite what the panel was getting at here. It's a bit unclear. We do know that any kinds of simulation analyses for these effects appear to be problematic given the very poor information, particularly about the winter. But we do make the point that there is evidence from other creatures out there, such as seabirds and marine mammals, that at very low prey abundance biomass, there may be a threshold where it is more critical to orcas, perhaps, than it is at more normal times. And so it does seem worthwhile to pursue this idea of a threshold that was suggested by some of the work that Eric did. And so we still wonder if it's really practical. Also, the predictability of it, if you did have a result that showed that there was a possibility that there was an increased dependence or vulnerability of southern residents to very low thresholds, can we predict those very low coast-wide reductions or low levels of the total prey of Chinook, so all stocks, whether or not that's predictable, and so a management response could be concocted is that's pretty questionable. So really, that's the highlights of our points. And in conclusion, I just wanted to make sure that the panel understood that we're not presenting you with a terrible slug sandwich here. It's not our intention to say, great job, but we really hit you with these problems that we see, and then keep up the good work. not our intention. We want to be constructive. We're available for you to pursue any of these questions or requests for clarification that we've made. We haven't had any interactions specifically. More coming tomorrow with Ken and Scott. And also Scott drew the short straw on the correlation causation panel. And so here at WDFW, we're available to have more interaction with you. Thanks.
Suggested that the italicized bold increase be changed to decrease, and
Well, we really didn't suggest that in this case, but I bolded it here just because it was a little bit confusing for us that it was used as increase, whereas we might have thought that the question about effect or an impact, if there was an impact that we thought was significant, that we might be considering changes to fisheries, and logically, I guess, it was that we might reduce fisheries catches to, so a reduction in salmon fisheries would have a detectable effect. Evaluating that, it really is any change, it could be neutral.
So you could say, a realistic increase in salmon abundance.
Yes, or you could say a realistic change in salmon abundance being neutral to whether it's increase or decrease.
It's a typo.
Well, those
with it, all problems could be so we can solve. They're all just
thank you.
Yes. Other questions in the mail?
I'm asking for a clarification on your last bullet here. You're saying that there may be threshold effects, but detecting them may be impractical?
Yes. Actually, the impractical part of it is if you did detect a threshold, I'm suggesting that one of the practical issues is how would you predict that change in abundance? Let's say if it was Chinook salmon, and at a very low, let's say a 50% reduction in availability of all Chinook stocks coast-wide, without getting into the stock-specific part of that. We make stock-specific forecasts each year for our fisheries management in the spring to generally address summer fisheries for the year. Could we predict such a large, massive, coast-wide reduction? Probably. Most likely it would be after we've seen a year or two of that occurring. And so the practical ability of seeing it out ahead of time before whales would have already suffered from the effects of very low abundance. I mean, in many cases, the predictions of abundance of salmon are in fact the early results of a brood, say in two-year-old Chinook salmon jacks coming back at very low abundance, indicating that subsequent age classes or brood classes are going to be in very reduced abundance. So, ability to predict long-term is somewhat problematic, even if a threshold could be defined about generally the impact being significant for southern resident killer whales due to very low Chinook salmon.
Any questions? Yeah, if you can grab a mic and drink.
Hi, my name is Eric Eisenhardt. I run the Soundwatch program. We're on the water with the southern resident killer whales 100 days a year. I just wanted to make a couple comments about it to support your points. The range of the southern resident killer whales, this August, K and L pods went up around Vancouver Island through Johnstone Strait. That's right in the middle of the summertime. So they're certainly feeding on stocks that are outside of Puget Sound, even the Northwest Straits. The other point is that L112, the whale that washed up on the outer coast of Washington back in February, had Chinook and halibut in her stomach, so they're also feeding on other species as well. So I just wanted to point that out. Just a comment.